Today's sponsor is Audible.com. Audible carries over 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get your free audiobook at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Support for this episode comes from PicMonkey.com. Now, once upon a time, photos only existed on paper, and if you wanted to edit them, you had to be a Russian spy or something. But now that we live in the digital photoverse, you can make everything look better with PicMonkey, an online photo editor. Design graphics, create collages, and take photos from meh to marvelous in just a click. Get a free trial of PicMonkey's premium subscription at picmonkey.com/undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to the sixth episode of Undisclosed. Today's episode is The Suspect. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow at the New America Foundation, and I'm joined with my colleagues Colin Miller, who is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and also is a blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. And we're also joined with Susan Simpson, an associate with the Volkov Law Group in D.C. and a blogger at The View from LL2. So let's start with a timeline check, just to refresh your memory. Haman Lee disappeared on January 13, 1999, and her body was found a few weeks later on February 9th. Now, Jay's first official interview, and remember, Jay is the state's star witness, and his first official interview with the police happened on February 27th, after which he allegedly led the police to Hayes' car in the early morning hours of the 28th, and a couple hours later, Adnan was arrested. Now, the question gets raised a lot about how the police actually got to Adnan. And the conclusion that a lot of people may come to, given the state's case, is that according to the police, 3 days after Hayes' body was found, on February 12th, an anonymous call came to the cops, telling them to take a look at her ex-boyfriend. That look resulted in the police pulling Adnan's cell records, which showed numerous calls to Jen, who led them to Jay, who handed them Adnan on a platter. But what if it wasn't the anonymous call that led them to Adnan? What if, long before this call, and long before talking to Jay, they already had their suspect, and now all they needed was to build a case against him? So how do you do that? You have to talk to witnesses, you have to collect evidence, and you have to do it in a way that supports the case against your suspect while looking the other way when things don't.
After the discovery of Hayes' body on February 9th, 1999, the first witness spoken to by police was a man we'll refer to on this podcast as Mr. A. Here's the report of his statement. On February 11th, 1999, Police Officer Bomrin, Baltimore County Police Department, Woodlawn Station, telephoned the homicide office and spoke to Lieutenant Keel. Officer Bomrin stated that a man had walked into the Woodlawn Station house and stated he had observed a black male driving a light-colored automobile behaving in a suspicious manner while in Lincoln Park near some concrete roadblocks. Sergeant Lehman and Detective Ritz responded to the Woodlawn Station, arriving at 21:45 hours. Upon their arrival, Sergeant Lehman and Detective Ritz were met by Officer Bomrin and Detective O'Shea. The walk-in witness was identified as follows: Mr. A. After interviewing Mr. A, it was determined that he had witnessed a young male acting suspicious near the concrete barriers blocking southbound traffic onto Weatherville Road from Windsor Mill Road, which is approximately a mile from the site of the victim's recovery. Mr. A states he heard of the recovery of a woman's body in Lincoln Park on the TV news and wanted to help. Your investigators believe that this observance is not connected to the murder of Haley.
Well, we have no idea why they concluded that. It certainly sounds relevant. And based on the information they've given in their brief memo of this interview, we have no reason to exclude it as relevant to the case. Just as way of background information, the place where Mr. A is talking about is, like I say, about a mile from where Hayes' body was found. It's kind of in the heart of Lincoln Park. It's at a place where a blocked-off road branches off from one of the main cut-throughs. So if someone had been able to get past the barrier there and onto the stretch of road, it would have been a very isolated spot and, in many ways, ideal for a place to dump a body. Unfortunately, it was barricaded by concrete roadblocks, so apparently whoever Mr. A saw couldn't get past them.
You know, it's also interesting to me that this description includes a light-colored automobile.
And, you know, Hayes' car was light colored and they had not found it yet. So at a minimum, I think it's surprising that they would not have followed it up further. I mean, there's nothing in the report that explains why they decided that there is nothing there.
I mean, if they wanted to show why Mr. A's report was not relevant, there's one easy detail they could have included: the date on which he saw this. If he saw this suspicious individual on February 5th or something, well, then there it's not relevant, so they can rule that out. But they didn't even bother to write the date down that Mr. A saw this event happen.
Right, whereas if he saw this event on January 13th, then it would be very relevant. And the other thing is that I found to be troubling is they just mentioned here a few times that he was behaving in a suspicious manner. He was driving suspiciously. There's no description of what that means. I wish we had more detail about exactly what this person was doing that basically led this individual, Mr. A, to not only note it, but go to the police once they had found this body in the park.
Yeah, and he was there for a while. This was in Baltimore County where he was and where he came in to tell them his story. So the Baltimore County police called the Baltimore City police and had them come out. So Mr. A was at the station for some time. He clearly thought it was important enough to be worth his time to go in there and wait and talk to them.
And we know that the police got the cell tower pings from Adnan's phone, right? And we know that a big part of their case, which we'll discuss later, are these phone calls on January 13th that ping the tower that covers the area, including Lincoln Park. Well, let's say, for instance, Mr. A says this behavior occurred on January 28th. Well, did Adnan's cell phone ping that tower during that time? If so, that would help their case greatly. But if not, then that could lead to either another individual having some type of involvement with the body, or it could be, as they say, irrelevant, but we just don't know from the lack of detail in this report.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like they dismissed it without investigating, but there had to be something behind that. Why would they dismiss it so quickly, right? And the obvious answer is because they already have an eye on another suspect, right?
It seems like at this point, they have already decided Adnan is their guy. Just before the official interview with the Baltimore police with Mr. A, at about 8 o'clock that evening, the Baltimore County officers were printing out Adnan's car records based on his license plate, which showed his car type, its color, make and model. So why are they doing that? It seems to be connected to Mr. A's report, based on the timing. And if so, why would they have been concerned with information like what color his car might have been? Well, it could have been to match up against Mr. A's report.
And that's not the first time, right, that the police have started looking at Adnan. We have documentation that, in fact, as early as February 3rd, they had already begun looking at Adnan. And this is even before her body was found.
Yeah, February 11th is the first date that the cops look at Adnan's car information. But on February 3rd, they had actually pulled his license information to see, for instance, what his record was, if he had any speeding tickets or other traffic violations on his record. But why were they pulling his license information on that date and no one else's? He was clearly already a person of interest and, based on the records, far more of interest than anyone else.
Yeah, and this tunnel vision on Adnan is troubling because when they put the blinders on in that way, what it causes them to not do is to talk to any Hayes friends. And so if we look at the timeline, again, Hayes' body is found on February 9th. We have no interviews with any of her friends until March 1st, which is finally when Adnan is arrested. And in fact, in that whole period between February 9th and March 1st, in addition to Mr. A, the only person that the police interview is Mr. Graham. Again, Mr. Graham was the athletic director of Woodlawn, and this relates to the question of whether Hay was filming her segment on January 13th. And so on February 22nd, the police interview Graham, and this is where Graham tells them that Hay was filming on January 13th, again, the day that she disappeared. But actually, if you look at Graham and we look at his statement, we've noticed before how we think Graham has the wrong day because Hayes' note is referring to the Randallstown wrestling match, which again was January 5th and not January 13th. But beyond that, if we look to Graham's statement, what he says is on January 13th, Hay was filming her segment for Athlete of the Week for the Education Channel. But an astute listener has pointed out to us, the Athlete of the Week recording actually wasn't done by the Educational Channel. They only did Athlete of the Month. And so the description given by Graham of the recording that Hay did on January 13th, as you said before, it doesn't seem to match reality because it's not the correct body that is performing the recording of this interview.
Yeah, and Graham also describes how the interview on the 13th involves lots of students. Well, we know that TEC, the Education Channel, did the interview of Hay that we've seen, because you can see the reporter's microphone, which has the logo on it. But TEC only did Athlete of the Month, which was just one male student and one female student. So there wouldn't be a big group. On the other hand, Athlete of the Week involved multiple students and a different channel entirely, and not the local Baltimore County School cable show. So Graham's description fits an interview for a different group entirely, and not the one we know that Hay was doing.
Yeah, it's just so strange for me. I don't understand why, what is it, about 20 days between her body being discovered and Adnan being arrested, none of these students are interviewed, and you find that Hay has been killed. Wouldn't you immediately then go to the students at Woonlawn to find her whereabouts and what she was doing on the afternoon of the 13th?
That's the obvious move to do. Apparently, it wasn't for them, though.
Yeah, and so basically we have to jump then all the way to March 1st when we have these interviews starting in earnest. And so March 1st is the date on which they interview Krista. Again, Krista has appeared on this podcast before. She was a good friend to both Hay and Adnan. The interview notes, though, are post-dated to April 27th.
So Krista is Hay's friend, and they are finally talking to one of Hay's friends, but they didn't talk to her because of that. They go to Krista because she was one of the people that was called on January 13th by Adnan's phone. They ask Krista, for instance, about the 538 call, which was 2 seconds long, and grilled her about why Adnan had been calling her then, what they talked about. Well, nothing, obviously, because it was 2 seconds and not a real call. But even now, their concern has nothing to do with what Hay was doing or what her plans were, and all about what Adnan was doing.
So I don't know how murder investigations generally happen, but or even missing persons investigation, but I have always found it really weird and odd. And I assume like the average layperson will too. That it's not until after they have arrested and charged a murder suspect that they start interviewing witnesses. Like, how does this make sense?
And people keep asking, well, how could they have gotten all this wrong about the date and what was going on that day? Well, this is probably a big part of why, because I didn't bother to look into it until weeks later.
Memory degrades over time, and they, I think, should have interviewed people at the school even when it was a missing persons investigation. But certainly by February 9th, they should have talked to these people. But instead, right, exactly, they're waiting till March. They're waiting until after Adnan has been arrested. That's going to play a role in the memory because it's, you know, you already have the suspect. And so it's basically the police building the case against Adnan as opposed to the police trying to build from the bottom up and figure out what actually happened to Hay.
Well, the Baltimore County Police did interview Hay's friends during the missing persons case. So they had those statements from Detective O'Shea. But again, those statements were about 2 sentences long each and tell nothing in terms of substance or detail about what Hay was doing. And clearly were not enough for the Baltimore City Police to figure out what had been going on that day.
Yeah, but as you say, Susan, at least with the Baltimore County investigation, they do have notes about these witnesses who were interviewed. I did mention how for Krista, they did, after the fact on April 27th, record the notes. That's not the case for the three interviews the next day. So again, Adnan is arrested on February 28th. Krista is interviewed March 1st.
Can I point out one thing, though?
Sure.
I love the fact that in April, when they did decide to write up the notes or possibly rewrite up the notes of Krista's interview, they dated February 29th. That was not a leap year. There was no February 29th.
Yeah, I mean, it just sort of shows the shoddy investigatory work, right? I mean, they're not even getting the day right of the very first person they interview after Adnan's arrested.
It doesn't even seem like not even getting the day right. That's not even like a, I mean, that is a deliberate attempt to change the date. I mean,
oh, right? I think they're just careless. I think they thought, well, we talked to Krista the day after we talked to Jay. We talked to Jay on February 28th. Therefore, I must have talked to Krista on February 29th and totally forgot that date didn't exist.
Yeah, and so then the next day we have three people being interviewed by the police. So this is March 2nd. We have Debbie being interviewed, again, a good friend to both Hay and Adnan. We have Aisha, who was Hay's best friend. And then we have a third person, Anne, who you haven't heard of before. Let's focus first on Anne. So who is Anne? According to Debbie, Anne, Adnan, and she used to spend basically every lunch period in the library. Anne was someone that Debbie was trying to set up with Adnan, and Adnan basically shied away from that because Anne had previously dated a Muslim friend of his, and so he didn't want to date her after the fact. And in fact, Anne is the last person who appears on Adnan's call log on January 13th, the day that Hay disappears at 10:30. And so that's probably why Anne was a person of interest and why she was interviewed there 2 days after Adnan was arrested. But no notes are taken, or at least no notes are turned over to Adnan. So for these three interviews on March 2nd, there's no notes of anything these three witnesses had to say. Debbie and Aisha eventually are called at trial. They do testify as witnesses for the prosecution. Anne, though, after her interview, is never contacted again by the prosecution or defense. She is not called as a witness at trial. And in fact, in one of Debbie's later statements, she says, when she's asked, why do you think Adnan is guilty? She responds, well, he was arrested. And also, Anne told me that the police said they had a bunch of evidence against him. So my thinking is, Anne actually maybe had something exculpatory to say about Adnan. That would explain why the police didn't follow up, and that would explain why she's not called. The question is, why didn't Gutierrez ever contact her?
Well, she must have said something of interest, because as soon as they talk to Anne, they add Anne's boyfriend and ex-boyfriend to their witness list, people to talk to. We don't know if they ever talked to them, actually, because they don't list that in the notes. But they do have them listed on a to-do list with their names scratched out, as if they had been talked to. So why did Anne lead the cops to interview two other witnesses that, again, are considered to be talked to or are talked to and never heard from again?
And one other piece of information we know about Anne is she was in that same final period AP psychology class with Adnan and Hay. And so you recall that this is the last time, at least according to what we think now, that Hay was seen alive was in this AP psychology class. My big question is, did Anne see Hay at the end of class and maybe have information that contradicted the state's theory of the case?
And Colin, you just mentioned how there are no notes from these three interviews in the record and how we don't know if they took them or not. Well, we actually do. There were statements from all three witnesses because they're listed on an index sheet in the police file.
Oh, that had the timing of the interviews. They're interviewed back to back to back. I think it's like 11:30, 12:30, 1:30. We have the exact time is when they're interviewed.
And written statements were taken for all of them. So why were they never handed over? And why aren't they in the file now?
Debbie gives a later statement at the end of March, and they're referencing things that were said in the prior interview. We know Aisha, at least via Krista, had some interesting things to say about that conversation between Hay and Adnan at the end of class. I really wonder what was said in those conversations. I mean, you wouldn't think that those notes would just be lost from the interviews. You would think there's something useful in those notes.
Well, here's the way I would look at it. If it was useful to the police and to the state, we would probably have those notes. But since it's not, they're not there. I mean, they just don't appear. We have the MPIA files. We have the files that were, given to us directly from the police that it's not in the case file at all. So I can only assume that either they were just misplaced or like on purpose or accidentally. And if it was on purpose, it was because maybe they wouldn't have been so helpful to the state.
Yeah, I mean, Anne's a big question mark. Aisha, we've heard from Krista in 2015, maybe has a very different story than what we have ever heard. As I said before, Debbie is maybe the most important person in this case. I've described before how she's given these various statements about, did she see Adnan at 2:45 at the guidance counselor's office on January 13th? Did she see Hay at 3 o'clock? Was she going to see Don? Was Takara their friend there? Did she ask for a ride? And Debbie's story changes a lot. It changes between the first and second trial. I'm really curious what she said in this interview because it's a big gap there. We don't know exactly how her story maybe was molded to eventually what it became.
So we don't have the notes from those interviews, but after they talked to Debbie, Aisha, and Anne, it was 3 weeks before the cops ever talked to anyone else who knew Hay. Before that, though, they did talk to other witnesses. On March 9th, about a week later, they talked to not her real name, Kathy slash Christy. As we've mentioned earlier, the fact they interview her at all is odd because as of March 9th, there is no statement from Jay or Jen, which indicates that Kathy had known anything about the murder or had interacted with Anand on that day. So why did the cops go talk to her? How'd they find out that she was a person of importance to their case? Well, my guess is that there were other statements from Jay and Jen that weren't recorded or not in any official interview that was ever disclosed to the defense.
Right. And we know, for instance, that Jen met with the prosecutor on, what was it, March 4th? And we have no notes from that. We know from Sis, the boss of Jay at the adult video store, that before February 28th, he had gone in to talk to the police, possibly about this case, or at least she says it was about this case, right? And we don't have any notes about anything that happened during those interviews.
And we know that during this time, the cops are also trying to learn cell phone records 101 and poring over the addresses of the various towers, and very likely also trying to compare locations of known places, including Kathy's address, which they had, with nearby towers, which could also explain why they decided to talk to her.
And then Susan, 2 days later, on March 11th, they follow up on talking to Kathy.
They talk to Jeff Jay. Jeff Jay is Kathy's boyfriend, who was there that night. He's the one that said, "Oh, snap," when Jay told him about the murder. Well, according to Jay, anyway. But again, they get a written statement from him. They talk to him, and poof, he goes away. We have no idea what he said. We have no idea if he would have backed up Jay's and Jen's and Kathy's stories, or if he said something else entirely.
Right, and then Susan, there's also a second person the police interview on March 11th. And so for context, if we look to Adnan's call log on January 13th, there's a call placed at 3:59 p.m. to Patrick. And it's a call lasting 25 seconds. And so with that context, then, who is this other person they interview on March 11th?
Patrice, Patrick's sister.
Right. And what do we know about that interview?
Nothing. Because, again, written statements taken, it's logged in the index, and it goes poof.
Just to be clear, when Susan said it goes poof, it means they're just not there. They've totally disappeared. We do not have copies of these statements. We just know that they were taken.
Right. So for breaking that down, then, we have 8 witnesses interviewed in the days after Adnan is arrested. Out of those 8 witnesses, we don't have interrogation notes for Jeffrey, Patrice, Debbie, or Aisha. So that's 5 out of the 8 where the state does not turn over anything that these, a majority of the witnesses they interview in those first days of the investigation, they're nowhere. There's a Supreme Court case, Brady versus Maryland. It comes from a Maryland case. It says under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, prosecution has a duty to turn over material exculpatory evidence. Now, were any of these statements exculpatory? Do they tend to exonerate Adnan? We have no idea because they were never turned over. It's bizarre. I mean, again, I've handled a number of these appeals cases and appellate cases. I've never seen something where in a state disclosure, we have all of these witness statements being made, and yet there's no documentation whatsoever of what these people said.
And let's take Patrice. In Jay's first interview on February 28th, Patrick's not mentioned. He's not part of the story. On March 15th, 4 days after the Patrice interview, Jay says that he called Patrick that day in order to find some weed. But Patrick wasn't home, so when he called, he got voicemail and then talked to Patrick's sister, Patrice. So if Patrice, in her interview, told the cops something other than that Jay had called her that day and was trying to get Patrick, well, that contradicts what Jay told the police and should have been produced under Brady.
Yeah, because Brady covers impeachment evidence. Impeachment evidence is evidence that contradicts and calls into question the credibility of a witness. Well, in this case, let's go to the timeline. Jay says that he was with Adnan and didn't drop him off to track practice until after 4 o'clock. And so this is a key part of the case. 3:59 on January 13th, he's making this call to Patrick's house and he's saying, "I had a conversation with Patrice." If Patrice contradicts that or has something to say that calls into question the credibility of Jay, that's huge. That's important evidence that Adnan could have used in his defense.
In addition to all the interviews that were definitely done, but for which notes were not kept or went poof, there's lots of witnesses that the cops contemplated talking to and arguably should have talked to who never got spoken to, at least didn't according to the records. For instance, other than Jeff Jay, Kathy's boyfriend, no one who Jay or Jen say had any knowledge of the murder prior to their interviews was ever talked to. That includes, for instance, Tayeb, Jay's friend Chris, Nicole, the one who Jen says told her about the strangulation, and later says told her about her mom finding Hayes' body in the park, Josh, Nicole's boyfriend, and Mark, possibly two Marks. There's Mark, Jen's brother, and there's Mark, may or may not be Jen's brother, who was in the car with Jen, Josh, and Nicole when they were discussing Hayes' murder.
Now, Mark, Jen's brother, I can't even imagine that, you know, this is somebody who could have easily corroborated that Jay spent the afternoon at Jen's house. I mean, his entire narrative is that I went over there to play video games with this guy. Like, the police never once, not only do they not interview him, Gutierrez also does not subpoena him.
Yeah, and this is part of why I never buy the whole claim that Jay's story changed to protect his friends. Because in his first statement, he was so willing to make Mark his alibi witness. And if Mark wasn't actually an alibi, why is he going ahead and throwing Jen's brother under the bus just to save his own skin? That's not the statement of a guy who's lying to protect friends. It's someone who, at best, is lying to protect himself, and at worst, just lying for God knows why.
You know, I can't help but wonder, though, if one of the reasons that they did not follow up with Mark was because, look, it was a school day, and he was, what, 13 or 14?
15.
He was supposed, 15, okay, so he was supposed to be in school. I mean, what if there was actually documentation that he actually was in school, and then that would totally undermine Jay's story?
Jen says she dropped Mark off at school that day, that morning.
And there's another thing, too, and Rabia, I believe, mentioned this in an earlier episode. I think there's a good reason why the police might have had concerns about Mark corroborating the story, because we've been mentioning Jay's first official interview. Well, before his interview was recorded, he had his pre-interview. And Robbie, I think you mentioned this before, in that pre-interview, Jay says on January 13th, again, the day that he disappears, there's an individual by the name of Jeff G. And Jay says in the pre-interview, Jeff G drove me to Woodlawn at 2:40 p.m. on January 13th to see Stephanie. Now, what do we make of that? It contradicts the Jen and Mark story, but also Jay supposedly has Adnan's car. Are we to believe that he gave someone else the car? And why is he going to Woodlawn? And what did he do at Woodlawn?
Isn't that the last place he'd want to say he was going if he knew it actually had happened?
We mentioned it before, but it's just seeing this again in the notes, it just shocks me that the very first thing on record that we have, it's a pre-interview, but it's still, it's him talking to the police. He's saying someone in their car drove me to Woodlawn at 2:40 on 113, and that person's never interviewed. That story is never mentioned again, but it's so strange.
Jeff G does come back. Jeff G is the one whose house Jay was driving to when Adnan made the come and get me call. That's it. After that, Jeff's just gone from the record, like everyone else. The first subpoena issued in this case was issued on February 16th, 1 week after Hayes' body was found in Lincoln Park. That subpoena was for Adnan's cell phone records. It's interesting, first of all, that they're even subpoenaing his cell phone records at this point, because it shows how focused they were on Adnan already in the investigation. It's also interesting because that subpoena gives a very strong indication that that wasn't the first information the police had about Adnan's cell phone records. In the subpoena, it says, to AT&T Wireless, you are therefore directed the 16th day of February, 1999, to furnish the names and addresses for the following telephone number and 13 cell site locations from January 1st, 1999 to the present. If this is the first subpoena that they've issued and the first cell phone records they've received, supposedly, how do they already know how many cell site locations they need addresses for?
Right, because Adnan's cell phone pinged 13 cell towers on January 13th.
From the J call onwards, yes.
So they must have known that to include it, right? I mean, they must have already, before February 16th, gotten information about the cell towers.
I can't think of another explanation for how the police would know the number of cell site locations it wanted addresses for, unless it had already obtained some kind of information. What happened, though, in response to that subpoena is that on February 17th, they got a list of all the call records from Adnan's cell phone, including the numbers of all the calls that Adnan had made and indications of the incoming calls he'd received, although not the actual phone numbers that the incoming calls came from. They could have obtained that information if they'd wanted to. I presume they knew that because they did obtain incoming call numbers in other cases, but they chose not to do that here.
Maybe the most frustrating part of this case, right? I mean, if we knew those incoming calls and who they, I mean, that would just, it would make the case so much clearer, which maybe they didn't want it. they wanted it ambiguous. But I mean, if we knew who these calls were from, that would just tell us so much more about January 13th.
If they had done their job and gotten information they should have gotten, this whole debate over what call was the come and get me call would never have happened. And in the current appeal, in the state's brief, they argue that Asia doesn't matter as an alibi because if they'd wanted to, they could have just changed the time of the come and get me call at trial because, you know, there's other calls it could have been. Well, if they'd gotten information they should have, that wouldn't have been an option. So perhaps it was strategic. They didn't want to narrow down their choices of when to make the time of the murder or when things had to have happened. If that's the case, it was a smart play because it worked out pretty well for him.
Is it also fair to say that if Gutierrez had tried, she probably could have gotten the records from the payphone at Best Buy if it actually existed?
Or the incoming calls on their numbers. I guess in her defense slightly, she would not have been as familiar with the cell phone records and wouldn't have necessarily known that it was possible to get the incoming call numbers, whereas the cops should have.
I mean, again, just comparing this to other cases that I've handled, I've never seen a case where they've only had the records of the outgoing calls and they haven't had this incoming call information. It's just baffling to me that they didn't get this information. It had to be a conscious decision where they didn't want the information.
Under the Stored Communications Act, there are various requirements that law enforcement and prosecutors have to abide by in obtaining certain records, such as telephone or computer records, including cell phone records. Some data, like BSI, basic subscriber info, they can obtain with just a subpoena. Other information, however, requires a court order, and that includes information like historic cell site location data, such as what cell sites calls originated on from a given cell phone. A court can only issue that kind of order if the government entity offers specific and articulable facts showing that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the contents of a wire or electronic communication, or the records or other information sought, are relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. I.e., in order to get this information, the cops have to explain, with specific and articulable facts, why they think it's going to show who did the crime, or something else material to the investigation. In the court order that the grand jury issued in order to obtain the cell site location data, the only specific and articulable fact that the state's order included was that Hay had been buried in Lincoln Park. This leads to the conclusion that the phone records were relevant and material to the investigation because they showed a link to Lincoln Park. It's almost as if the state already knew what it'd find.
Based on looking at this, this is my general theory of this investigation. I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but at some point in February 1999, the police realized the Adnan cell phone pinged the tower that covers Lincoln Park at 7:09 and 7:16. And from that moment on, whether consciously or unconsciously, they, in talking to witnesses and building their cases, they built their entire theory of the case around Adnan being in Lincoln Park at 7:09 and 7:16. As we said in the prior episode, it doesn't meet with medical evidence. It contradicts it. But that's my theory is whenever they found that the 7:09 and 7:16 pings, that is what formed the foundation of this entire investigation and prosecution.
And there's one thing that could explain how this came to be. And that's if a tower dump was done. A tower dump is basically taking a certain cell site and obtaining all the calls and all the phone numbers of all the calls that were made through that tower for a given time range. If the cops had done that for the Lincoln Park Tower, L689, which they could have done without an order, they would have found that two calls had been made to a non-cell phone through the Lincoln Park Tower on January 13th, a little after 7 p.m. So if that happened, say, February 11th, February 10th, it would explain what went on in this investigation, why they knew the cell phone records were important, why they knew where to look, why they knew what the connections were, why they knew what cell sites they needed addresses for. There's other explanations too, but that's one I'd be very curious to find out more about.
Right, yeah, and there's been a lot about this in the news recently about these cell tower dumps, right? So that's the tower is L689, and what they would have done is no requirement of a warrant, although that's being challenged a bit now. They would say January 13th, maybe January 14th, give us every single phone that pinged the L689 tower. From that, they get the 709 and 716 pings to Adnan's phone, and then that's the launching pad for this entire case.
Now, tower dumps were relatively new at this time period. They were not in common use. They were still kind of a rarity. But there was one agency that was kind of leading the pack when it came to, well, cell record information in general, and tower dumps in particular. And that's the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. So would the Baltimore City Police have known to do a tower dump in February 99 in a murder case they were investigating? Probably not. It's not something that was very common on a local level. But the Baltimore Police had ties to the DEA, and if they needed information about how to conduct a cell record investigation, the DEA could have helped them. And the DEA could have told them easily how to find a tower dump and why it was important for the investigation.
And the DEA did, right?
Well, we don't know if the DEA was involved in a tower dump or if a tower dump was done, but we know the DEA was helping the Baltimore Police in conducting their investigation as it pertained to the cell phone records. We know the DEA was involved very early on because on February 18th, the day after the Baltimore Police had received the call records from a non-cell phone, the DEA was issuing a subpoena for the subscriber information for every phone number that Adnan had called during the first 72 hours that he'd had the cell phone. Again, the DEA was more familiar with cell phone records. They knew what they were doing in a way that the Baltimore Police clearly did not. They were a useful resource for the Baltimore Police to use. But it shows how and why the DEA could have been assisting even earlier on and helped them obtain other information that we don't have access to today. And this isn't speculation. We know it's possible that the DEA could have submitted subpoenas on behalf of the Baltimore Police, and we would not have those records because that happened. Later on, the DEA submitted a subpoena for Bilal's cell phone records.
Just as a reminder, Bilal was a community member and kind of a youth leader who knew Adnan very well, and also was, in fact, the person who helped get Adnan his cell phone, because Adnan wasn't old enough to get one, and so Bilal helped him do that.
And the only reason we know that the DEA issued a subpoena for this is that in the cover letter from Bilal's phone service provider, they mentioned it's in response to a DEA subpoena, which we don't have a copy of. So it's not speculation to say that the DEA could have been issuing subpoenas that were never provided to the defense or produced in the police file. Because that definitely happened. The question is how many times it happened.
Right. Did they subpoena Jen's phone records, for instance, where those 709 and 716 calls are supposedly from her? Did they subpoena her records and find out they weren't from her? Well, we don't know because they didn't turn over the DEA subpoenas. Right. And as you say, the only reason we know from Bilal is paperwork from the response, not from the actual DEA subpoena.
I mean, did they request a tower dump? It's things we can't answer. And frankly, concerns the hell out of me if a police agency can get away with not producing paperwork about subpoenas by routing them through a federal agency.
Now, you know, when I first saw the paperwork on the DEA stuff, I was a little bit shocked because I thought this immediately meant that there was some connection to, like, this case was connected to, like, a narcotics crime or something. And then there's also the connection of Kevin Urich having been a prosecutor in the narcotics division and not homicide before. And I admit that I did wonder for a bit if we had a case of there being like a police informant here who was being protected then by the police. But it seems like that this was something that was just really a way for Baltimore to take a shortcut and get the records they wanted.
Which isn't a problem in itself. They have resources that Baltimore police didn't have. It's the lack of disclosure and the failure to acknowledge or produce subpoenas that were being issued on behalf of the Baltimore police that's the problem here. Aside from the fact of who was issuing subpoenas, either the DEA or the Baltimore City Police, there's a question of who these subpoenas were directed towards, whose cell phone records were being produced. Now, the subscriber information for a lot of people was produced, which is just the phone number, the name of the subscriber, and various other account details. But for actual toll records, the actual call logs, the police only subpoenaed records for Pakistani and Muslim individuals. They didn't get Jay's, they didn't get Jen's, they didn't get Patrick's, anyone else's, other than, well, Anand, Anand's home phone, Yasser's cell phone, Bilal's cell phone records, and lastly, the Gill's phone records.
Yeah, so I thought this was really fascinating when Susan first told me, and actually Susan asked me, who's Elfrida Gill? And I said, Elfrida Gill? Where did that name come from? Because I know who Elfrida Gill is. Elfrida Gill is a lady who is a Pakistani Christian who is based in the area. And she's been a activist and kind of a like community organizer and a social event organizer really since I was a kid. I mean, we called her Auntie Elfrida. And I didn't know her connection at all to the case, but it seems like they subpoenaed her phone records because of something kind of minor, right, Susan?
Yeah. In March, Anand's dad went to Woodlawn High School to pick up his school records so that he could continue his studies while in jail. Alfreda Gill came with him to act as moral support and to help him get the records. A Woodlawn High School official wrote down Alfreda Gill's name and license plate number and later told the police about this event and gave them Alfreda Gill's information. The police then decided to go and subpoena all of her call records. Why? Well, it's unclear why. I mean, she clearly, other than being a friend of the Syed family, has no connection to this case. And they don't bother to get Jay's or Jen's numbers, but they want hers?
Well, the connection she has, of course, not just being their friends. She's, you know, Adnan has other friends too, but she happens to be somebody who's Pakistani. Maybe she's Muslim. Maybe they don't know. But, you know, this is an issue that was raised briefly by Serial, but it is an issue that has troubled me a lot about this case over the last 16 years. And that's the angle the police took, because really, like, the theory of the case in terms of Adnan's motive was that he was a Muslim male who, in a fit of rage or feeling dishonored, killed Hay, and that this was actually part of the culture allowed this to happen and was okay with it to happen. We're going to hear about the bail hearing later and how the community reacted when the state kind of offered this. There's this cultural consultant memo that was shown to me first a few months before Serial aired, and I hadn't seen this before that because it was not in the files that I had. And this was a memo written by an agency that does a lot of different things, but one of the things they do is like kind of cultural competency consulting. And what's interesting is that it seems their first interaction with the police was on February 15th of 1999.
This agency actually did consult with the Baltimore County Police as part of the missing person investigation, and they got in contact with the Baltimore City Police as part of the murder investigation in February.
So can I ask you, Susan, why do you think they would get involved in the missing persons investigation? I mean, what is it this agency, this firm did or does that would make sense?
They do lots of things. They do, I'll read you there. They do business investigation, missing person investigation, computer fraud, industrial counter-espionage, translation, software design, and market trend analysis.
That's what their website says right now.
That's what their record says in the MPIA.
So a portion of a document, a police report says, on February 15th of 1999 at approximately 1405 hours, your investigator had the occasion to respond to Annapolis, Maryland and speak with a consultant with the Inihi Group. So it seems on February 15th of 1999, and remember, this is a few days after Hay's body is found, Baltimore City Police actually meet with a consultant with a group called the Inihi Group. This person is a consultant that works out of Annapolis and also happens to be a friend of Hay's uncle. Now, Hay's uncle contacted his friend, this consultant, who does missing persons investigation in an attempt to gain additional information. Apparently, you know, this consulting firm was part of the missing persons investigation, then worked further on with the homicide investigation, and also is the firm that's responsible for the cultural memo that shocked me and shocked a lot of people, because it basically kind of was this really poorly informed primer on Islam and Muslims and Pakistanis that was just not just inaccurate, but highly inflammatory and I would say really bigoted and just wrong on so many counts. And so, you know, from February 15th is the earliest that, you know, they're already kind of part of the homicide stuff. But, you know, it seems to me like that might have been when kind of the seeds for framing this as a Muslim honor killing type of thing might have begun, because we know sometime in March there's police notes to call the consultant for letters and veil. Although we're not sure about what letters they mean, the veil they seem to be referring to is a scarf that Adnan had purchased for Hay when they were going out as a gift. And that scarf, which they're calling a veil, figures kind of importantly in the cultural memo that was later, I guess, drafted. So I'm going to read from a portion of that memo just to remind you of how they interpreted that gift of a scarf. Clearly, Mr. Syed faced almost insurmountable odds to meet with this infidel or devil in secret. Ownership is not outside of his cultural belief system. After giving her a veil, literally covering her so that only he could have her, he set her apart from all others and for him alone. For all intents and purpose, he marked his territory by giving her a gift of great value within his culture, and in doing so, he sealed her fate with this. By receiving it, perhaps unwittingly, Hei Min Li accepted his standard of decorum. To have later been let down by her relationship with another man would certainly have been an obvious violation of his culture and a reason to destroy her. For her to have another man dishonored both Adnan Syed and his belief structure. It is acceptable for a Muslim man to control the actions of a woman by completely eliminating her, and still remains possible under this system to find peace and forgiveness with God at the same time. Within this harsh culture, he has not violated any code. He has defended his honor. Hei Min Li's womanhood diminished both her worth and the act of violence resulting in her death. Under Islamic law, her murder was sanctioned. For many ethnic Pakistanis, incidents like this are a commonplace, and in Pakistan, this would not have been a crime, but probably a matter of honor. So, you know, the memo goes on. It's much longer. I mean, it has a really ridiculous preface about just Pakistan in general. And we can put that up on our website. But I'll tell you that every time I revisit this, I don't know if I should laugh or cry because it is such a pile of horseshit. I can't even tell you. And this became the basis of the state's theory. I know that Sarah didn't necessarily feel that it was really like instrumental to their case, but I really do think it was. I think this is what drove them to fix on Adnan, more so than him even being the ex. But I don't know, maybe because it's much more painful and personal to me to read this and to think that police and prosecutors in the state that, you know, our tax dollars fund would frame this case in this way. And it's just so bigoted and unconstitutional.
I'm probably being over-optimistic, or I don't know, but I would like to believe that no one believed this in their hearts. They just saw it as a convenient way to frame their case and get a conviction, and that it didn't actually believe stuff they were saying. But again, does that make it worse or better?
If it were just this private document they never shared, that might be one thing, but I will get to the bail hearing in a couple episodes. And that's a huge part of this case, is that they're claiming, you know, this is justified under his religion and culture. And that, I mean, that's just hard. This is probably the most awful thing I've ever seen in a file in a case is this document. It's just terrible. It's complete stereotyping. It's Islamophobia. And it informs our understanding of exactly what the state was doing in this case.
In addition to filing subpoenas for the cell phone records, subpoenas were issued for other documentary records in this case. But the timing of these subpoenas raises some red flags for me. For instance, the dumpsters. The ones where Jay says he threw away the shovels and his clothes, and Anand threw away Hei's property. They wait until March 19th to even look for those items. They file a subpoena for the dumpster company to look for it. But before that, they never even attempt to find those items.
Yeah, I mean, if they thought it was a dead end, fine, they never subpoena it. But yeah, why wait from the 28th all the way to March 19th? I mean, if you think there's any possibility it's fruitful, and this is important evidence, this is a connection between Jay and the crime scene, why wait 20 days before you decide to serve these subpoenas for the dumpsters?
And it wasn't a lost cause if, for instance, Jay says he threw away the pick and the shovel and a recycling dumpster. That's not going to get overlooked. Someone's going to notice that at the facility or somewhere that, in addition to cardboard boxes, they've got shovels and a pick, or a shovel, who knows. Those items could have been found if they existed. Why didn't they look earlier?
They were afraid that
they weren't there? Maybe. And then let's take Best Buy. On February 27th, Jen tells them that the murder took place at Best Buy. Jay says that took place down by Poplar Grove, but later on March 15th, he too says the murder happened in Best Buy. You'd think the obvious course of action would be to maybe go to Best Buy and ask if anyone saw anything or if something was amiss. The video footage, the security cameras, were probably already recycled, so that's probably a no-go. But still, if someone gets murdered in a parking lot and the body is moved from the passenger or driver's seat to the trunk in broad daylight at 3 p.m., I mean, there's a good chance someone might have noticed something. They wait until April 13th to go look at Best Buy and find out what was going on, and to subpoena the records from that day to find out if anything was recorded, who was working there that day. I mean, a month and a half after they first learn of where the murder scene may have been, they finally decide to go check it out.
Yeah, in the heart of this case, I mean, this is a first-degree murder with premeditation. It is kidnapping by fraud and false imprisonment by fraud. And the crux of the state's case is Adnan gave Jay his cell phone so he could call him and that he called her from Best Buy. And so, yeah, looking at Best Buy, getting those incoming phone numbers to determine, was there in fact a phone call placed to Adnan's cell phone from the Best Buy payphone, assuming there even was one, and it was in the location that Jay said. I mean, that's just, it's fundamental to the case. I mean, that's the heart of it. You have to confirm that.
If you're not checking out a murder scene because you think your witness lied to you, don't present that story at trial as the real story.
And we know from Jay's Intercept interview last winter, right now he says his car wasn't in the Best Buy parking lot, that Adnan just walked up, the trunk pop occurred later, and so...
And that he learned that the murder probably didn't happen there either.
Right.
He didn't say where, he wouldn't offer that up, but he did say, oh, by the way, it wasn't at Best Buy after all.
Right, so in terms of building a case, they probably did it the right way, because, in fact, whoever committed this murder likely wasn't at Best Buy, or at least Jay has no knowledge of it occurring at Best Buy.
So again, the only way I can explain and excuse the detective's failure to search there is if they didn't actually believe it had anything to do with the murder in the first place. What's also frustrating about the subpoenas is that a lot of them we know were issued. We have the documents that show the subpoenas were sent out, but we don't have the returns. We don't have whatever the recipient of the subpoena sent back to the police. And those subpoenas include a subpoena to the dumpster company, subpoena to the Best Buy, subpoena for Jay's employment records, subpoena for Jen's employment records, other than the ones for her lifeguard job, and perhaps for me, the most interesting and frustrating and aggravating, the subpoena for Jen's pager. So the cops did subpoena, through the DEA, the number that Jay identified as Jen's pager number. The results they got back said, this is a number we assigned to another pager company, which is pretty common. They often traded numbers among themselves. So just because one number was originally registered to one company didn't mean that it was actually the same company that gave it to the final consumer. So the police had to follow a bit of a chain to find out where Jen's pager actually ended up and who actually was a subscriber for it. And they do follow it up. They eventually find out that the person who issued that pager number was a company called Pincel, and they sent a subpoena out to find out the subscriber data. Those returns are not in the file. We have no idea what that pager company said to the police about whose pager that was. And that wouldn't be a big deal, except for the fact that there's good reason to question whether it was really Jen's pager in the first place. We have tried to look into this now. We cannot find out who the subscriber was in early 1999, but we do know that the number seems to have been issued from Ocean City, Maryland. Not sure of the connection there with Jen, but we also know that at trial and in his early police statements, Jay does not identify that pager number with Jen's pager. In fact, in the first trial, he's asked, do you know who placed that page to the number that's being called Jen's pager number? And he says, that was me. I did that while I was sitting in the car, waiting for him. I was supposed to meet somebody at some place at 7 o'clock. So I paged him and told him I was probably going to be late. Male pronouns. Why is he using male pronouns to refer to Jen's pager? And perhaps more telling is Kathy's testimony. Also in the first trial, she is shown a list of the calls that were made from Adnan's phone on the 13th, and she's asked, I'm going to show you what's been pre-marked as State's Exhibit 34. This is a compilation of the defendant's cell phone records, and I ask you to take a look at the phone numbers in the second column and see if you recognize any of those numbers. Kathy says, in reference to the Pusateri home residence number, that's Jen's, that's her number. That shows up a couple times on here. But I don't know any of the other numbers on here. Again, three of those numbers were Jen's pager. Kathy's looking at them and says, I don't recognize any number here but Jen's home number. And she's Kathy's best friend. Why can't she recognize Jen's pager if it's actually Jen's pager?
And Jen's pager is important because it's kind of instrumental, I mean, in the narrative of that evening, how Jay then contacts Jen from Lincoln Park and then she calls him back. And for it to make sense for the state's case, it had to have been her pager. But we are just not sure of that now.
The number identified as Jen's pager is called at 7 o'clock p.m., so right before the Lincoln Park pings, 8.04 p.m. and 8.05 p.m. Very important times on January 13th, and we have significant doubt about whether, in fact, that was Jen's pager.
One thing that's also in the records is that the police were issuing grand jury subpoenas after Adnan had been indicted. That's not allowed. It's not cool. But they got away with it because, obviously, the defense didn't know it was happening. And people receiving the subpoenas didn't know that they were invalid. Because a grand jury subpoena, obviously, is only issued in connection with the grand jury proceeding, which terminates once an indictment has been issued. In this case, April 13th. However, up until late April, the police were still issuing grand jury subpoenas to obtain information in this case.
The subpoena, it's issued by the clerk of court. It's either telling someone to appear before the grand jury or to produce documents for that grand jury proceeding. And so if you're having a grand jury subpoena, it has to be before the indictment, which is the grand jury deciding there's probable cause to take the case to trial. And right, exactly. You can't have grand jury subpoenas after indictment, which is what they were doing in this case. Was it an oversight, like many things in this case? Possibly. Was it misconduct? It's also a possibility.
It's mild misconduct. They were getting away with it because they could. And it was easier to do it that way. So there's one last witness that the police interviewed that we haven't talked about yet. And that's Adnan himself.
Adnan was only interviewed in person once, and that was on February 26, 1999, the day before we know Jay had his first official taped interview.
And about an hour before Jen's first interview.
But the police had called him on January 13, according to Officer Adcock's notes and also Adnan himself remembering that phone call.
We actually have two write-ups of this interview. The first one's dated February 27th, the day after the interview. And it says only that during this interview, Mr. Syed provided personal information, along with information as to his relationship with Haman Lee. This was not produced to the defense, and it's pretty innocuous. It doesn't say anything in particular about the interview. And it was written a day after the interview took place, so it was still fresh in the detectives' minds. However, on September 3rd, shortly before trial, the prosecution informed the defense that a report is being written which documents the last known interview of the defendant prior to his arrest. And no report was actually produced, however, and on November 9th, the prosecution wrote a new disclosure, this time stating, "The state erred in its amended disclosure of September 3rd when it said a report was being prepared concerning an interview conducted with the defendant. In fact, that report concerned an interview with a different witness. All required discovery concerning statements made by or interviews conducted with the defendant have been made."
So November 9th is like literally about a month before Adnan's first trial. And at this point, his attorney has no documentation of that interview that Adnan gave to the police on the 26th of February. But finally, the state does turn something over, right? When do they do that, Susan?
January 18th, just before the second trial.
So on January 18th, the prosecution, the state, turns over before the second trial. Now, mind you, again, the defense counsel did not have the statement before the first trial. They turn over a statement that's actually dated for September 14th. So on September 14th, somebody decided to sit down and do a summary of the interview that was taken with Adnan on the 26th of February. And this is how it reads. "On 26 February 1999, at approximately 1900 hours, your investigator, along with Detective William F. Ritz, had the occasion to respond to Adnan's house and interview Adnan Syed in the presence of his father. During this interview, Syed relayed the following information. Syed indicated that he knew the victim, Haman Lee, and that she was a friend of his. He also indicated that he had known the victim for several years. On January 13, 1999, he had the occasion to be at school, Woodlawn Senior High, however, doesn't remember the events that occurred in school that day. When asked if Syed had a relationship with Haman Lee, Syed replied in a soft voice, yes. However, he didn't want his father to know. Syed indicated that he had occasion to be a passenger in the victim's auto, however, not on the date in question. Syed stated that he had no idea who would want to have hurt Haman Lee and that he could provide no information on suspects. Syed indicated that Haley had been seeing an individual named Don who apparently worked with the victim at LensCrafters. Your investigators asked Syed's father if it would be possible to speak with Syed at school on a later date. Same indicated that it would be possible if he was present. Investigation to continue. Respectfully, Detective McGillivray."
This memo bugs me on two fronts. First, why is it so much more detailed than the memo that was written the day after Adnan's interview? And second, why wasn't it produced earlier? Now, it's dated September 14th, which is shortly after the prosecution's September 3rd disclosure, in which they stated that a report was being prepared of Adnan's interview. So that kind of matches. It seems like the September 14th memo was written in conjunction with that disclosure. Why then in November does the prosecution inform the defense that it was mistaken? There's no memo. In fact, the memo we were talking about was for a different witness entirely. Now, there is no other memo produced of a witness statement from September of 1999. I mean, it's hard to see how this could just be a mistake on the prosecution's part.
Oh, no, that's the biggest thing for me because, I mean, the strange thing is this statement that Adnan gives, it's completely innocuous, right? I mean, he doesn't really remember the day. He wasn't in her car. I mean, there's nothing that incriminates him. The most interesting thing to me is, right, what you say, where actually we have this other report concerning an interview with a different witness. Well, who's this witness and what happens to their interview? That's what's important to me because, yes, this is shady and it violates the rules of discovery, but what they actually produce doesn't hurt Adnan in any way.
So we either have the prosecution making a bizarre lie about how there really was no memo of Adnan's interview, or we have there actually being some other memo of another witness that was never produced.
Again, those 5 out of 8 witnesses who were interviewed those few days after his arrest, they're never produced. Was it one of them? All of them are pretty important.
I could see it going either way. I don't know why the prosecution would have lied here, but maybe they did, or maybe it really did exist, and who knows what it was.
So the way that I see it, the police actually never bothered to investigate this crime to find out what really happened to Hay. They limited their investigation to what they could use to build a case against Adnan. They zoned in on their suspect early. They interviewed schoolmates and teachers after he was already arrested. They nailed down a motive using the cultural consultant. And they pulled phone records for only Pakistanis or Muslims connected to Adnan, and not records for Jay, Jen, Patrick, Phil, people actually connected to the case that the police had developed themselves. They wait for 3 weeks to attempt to find the burial tools Jay said that he disposed of, and then another month before sending a subpoena to Best Buy. And they fail to contemporaneously document, and then refuse to hand over until the second trial, notes from the only in-person interview with Adnan. Of course, there was a second interview, and that interview happened 2 days later, on the 28th of February, 1999, when Adnan was finally arrested. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoy. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer. And you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed. Do you own a car? Then you know how expensive it is. From a recent AAA study, your car costs you $9,000 a year. Ouch. But what if your car paid you instead? Enter Relay Rides. Relay Rides is a peer-to-peer car rental company. You can rent out your car on Relay Rides and earn as much as $1,000 a month. Relay Rides pre-screens each renter and offers $1 million insurance. A special offer for Undisclosed listeners. Earn an extra $100 when you sign up today for free at relayrides.com/undisclosed.